You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 24th of August 2016 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, the UK's extremely slow-motion exit from the EU. We'll look at why one widely predicted consequence, another push for independence by Scotland, looks less and less likely. US Vice President Joe Biden arrives in Ankara to begin the not inconsiderable task of repairing the United States' relationship with Turkey. What might Washington be willing to concede, or indeed extradite, in order to get Turkey back on board? We'll look at reports that recent terror attacks are persuading some Europeans to become more American in their attitude to guns, and we'll ask if Canadians and Australians are going to want news from an American source, even if it is the New York Times. That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. And welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Michael Binion and Raffaello Pantucci. Michael is a foreign affairs specialist for The Times. Raffaello is the Director of International Security Studies at the Royal United Services Institute. Welcome both. Now, learned scholars of British politics will be aware, of course, that most of the last few days has been substantially consumed by a row over whether or not the Leader of the Opposition was unable to find a seat on the 11 o'clock from King's Cross to Newcastle. While this splendid silly season stramash has played out, however, actually important things have been occurring both north and south of the border. North first, we will look to Scotland, where Nicola Sturgeon, the First Minister, wants to appoint a Brexit minister to handle Scottish interests in the negotiations. Michael, first of all, other than the obvious one of Scotland not actually wanting to leave the EU, what specifically Scottish interests are in play here?
Well, the interest is to get as good a deal for Scotland in any Brexit negotiations as possible. And I think that Nicola Sturgeon has taken this step because she's realised, to her great reluctance, that the quick and easy option of another referendum on independence just won't work, because it doesn't look as though the polls have moved very much since the Brexit vote on independence.
Well, indeed, if there's not that she would have needed instruction in the lesson, because she's clearly a very organised and competent politician,
oh, yes.
But if ever we needed proof of the wisdom that you don't call a referendum unless you're pretty sure of the result, this year has provided it.
Absolutely, yes, absolutely. And therefore, she's the second option is to make sure that Scotland has as much leverage as possible and secures some kind of deal that is as close to staying in as she can persuade the British government to embrace, though I think actually that's going to be a hard job.
Raffaello, are we looking at then Nicola Sturgeon resiling from the idea of a second independence referendum? Because, of course, one of the defining images of that very strange morning immediately following the vote, you know, we'd had David Cameron tearfully resigning on the steps of Downing Street. And then immediately afterwards, Nicola Sturgeon appeared on all known media, flanked by the flags of Scotland and the European Union. You didn't need an advanced understanding of political semiotics to figure that one out, did you?
No, I think it was a pretty clear steer. And I think, you know, it was reflecting to some degree what we'd seen in the vote, which was a majority in Scotland had voted to stay in. And so there was this great sense of tussle. But I think it was a lot of emotional kind of rhetoric. And there was a perception and certainly a discussion in the sort of commentariat about the fact that maybe this presaged a new Scottish referendum. And we did see, if you look at polls, a bit of a spike afterwards.
And she did make the point that this is a material difference, as she put it, to
exactly.
Scotland.
And that was always the kind of the rationale that was given. You know, it would have to be something so substantially different that we'd have to go back and ask people to vote again. But I think that since then, we've seen polls go back down. And actually, if you look at the numbers, they're not indicative of the fact that it has materially changed the sort of Scottish perception. Now, once we get to the sort of end of the Brexit negotiations and we have a clearer sense of what exactly the role is, it's possible that we might revisit this question. But my sense is that there is a perception in Scotland that maybe all that discussion about doing another referendum straight away is a bit premature.
I have to say, I've been surprised by this, Michael, although by this point, I should have stopped being surprised when things I predict completely fail to actually happen. But I would have assumed...
Well, the pollsters are wrong.
Indeed. But I, for one, would have assumed that after the referendum vote went the way it did, that there would be an enormous clamour for independence in Scotland, which voted quite decisively for Remain. But the polls, as they are now, show... no spike in support for a referendum and actually 53% in favour of remaining in the UK. Why do you think it is there has been no surge in pro-independence feeling in Scotland?
Easy. There's no money. There simply isn't any money to pay for independence. And the North Sea oil price has gone through the floor even since the last referendum. And that is a catastrophic underpinning to any attempt to be an independent nation. And I think a lot of canny Scots know that and realise that there simply isn't the financial backing for any new push for independence.
It is hard to imagine, isn't it, Rafaela, that had Scotland won its independence when it voted for it, that what's happened to oil prices since, the consequences would have been much other than disastrous.
Yeah, I mean, certainly in a way they sort of dodged a bullet, you know, because if the oil prices at that moment were very high, they were looking very flush, you know, now subsequently they'd be looking at a very big thing. I think some of the reporting was saying that like the government has a £15 billion black hole needs to be filled.
9.5% of GDP in Scotland versus 4% in the UK as a whole.
Which I think makes them quite reliant on the Treasury here in London, you know, so I think that whole dynamic has changed. But I think the other point is that I don't know that we have, the Brexit vote was a sort of material change, but we don't know what that means yet. And so I think that the underlying rationale why people voted remain in the Scottish referendum, why they were voted to stay in the UK, probably still holds to some degree. So I don't think that dynamic has changed. I think the dynamic that changed in Scotland was very much more the sort of thrashing of the Labour Party at the last election, which was sort of a reshaping of the electoral dynamics up there. But I don't know that to me presage a sort of direct push, a new push towards independence. I think it was more kind of continuing rejection of kind of Westminster elites, but at the same time, the overriding sense that yes, we are still part of this United Kingdom.
Well, back here in London, we've seen the newish Justice Minister, Liz Truss, recommitting to the Conservative Party's manifesto pledge to scrap the Human Rights Act. Michael, it's hard to make that look good in terms of political symbolism when you have something called the Human Rights Act saying we're going to abolish the Human Rights Act. They're talking, of course, of replacing it with a British Bill of Rights. What is the imaginable earthly difference between the two, do we think?
Well, it's actually quite important, and I think it's actually not as stupid a move as people might have thought. It's smart because, in most people's mind, they simply can't tell the difference between the European Union and the European Court of Human Rights, the European Strasbourg-based Council of Europe.
Because the Human Rights Act, of course, has been one of the bogeymen most frequently cited by the Leave campaign.
Exactly. And it's nothing to do with the European Union. It came long before it.
That detail they usually left out.
Exactly. And, of course, what people have objected to is rulings from Strasbourg, from the court, that certain decisions taken in British courts can be overruled, in particular things like the right of prisoners to vote or various other human rights issues, privacy or freedom of information, things of this kind. And there is a real feeling that we are not going to be told by a foreign court how our courts should run our country. And that plays right into the sovereignty issue, which was part of the whole Brexit campaign. And I think, therefore, and the other thing, of course, has been the difficulty of sending prisoners, or at least people detained, back to their own countries where it was deemed that they might face persecution. And we've had notorious cases of terrorists who are clearly a threat to British security, who we've been obliged to hang on to for years. Now, if that is no longer going to rule our courts, then, of course, Britain can trumpet the fact that it has now regained a certain amount of legal sovereignty.
And on that basis, Rafaela, would that be a way for Theresa May and the others at the top of government, who are clearly not terrifically keen on the idea of leaving the European Union, looking forward a few years, could this be a bone that gets thrown to the people who voted to leave in order to try and find a slightly less drastic resolution?
I'm 100% sure that's the case. But then the other point I'd make is all of the issues which Michael quite correctly laid out about things that had sort of been held up in terms of deportation of people, in terms of getting rid of terrorist suspects, these are all issues that would have landed on Theresa May's desk. And so they're all issues that she would have been handling, and that I know her at the Home Office have been worrying about and being quite irritated about for some time. So in some ways, I think, you know, as soon as she ascended to the prime ministership, it was sort of a certainty that something along these lines was going to happen, because amongst the sort of cabinet members who were very keen for this to happen, she was very much at the forefront of it. So I think that it's something that was probably already in play. I think politically speaking, they will certainly roll it out as something to show the Brexiteers that, you know, yes, you see the government is trying to push in this direction, which is frankly something they're going to have when they get to, you know, 2 years down down the line and discover a whole series of promises that were made are going to get broken, and to have something that they can actually put in the sort of plus side of the ledger is undoubtedly playing into their considerations.
It's also fairly cost-free, if I could say. I mean, it doesn't cost us economically anything. It's simply an agreement. And if you replace it with a Bill of Rights, that sounds pretty democratic and nice. Our first Bill of Rights, you know, it's true that scrapping a Human Rights Act doesn't sound too good, but if you...
The whole nasty party thing kind of comes out again, you know. So.
Yeah. Well, just before we move along, Michael, I will ask you, as a veteran of Fleet Street, I have to get your assessment of where train gate rates on the rank of... Because this is a great old-school silly season story, isn't it?
Oh, it's wonderful.
And we didn't really get to have a silly season this summer because there was too much actual news, most of it incredibly depressing. But this is a belter, isn't it?
Well, trains are in the news at the moment anyway because people are fed up with strikes and things like that. And therefore, a train story where it suddenly looks as though the politicians have been telling lies. And, of course, the person who owns Virgin Trains, Richard Branson, is a pretty flamboyant figure anyway. So you've got a nice knockabout with a big businessman taking on a rather fumbling leader of the Labour Party. It's good knockabout stuff.
Excellent. Well, let's move along now to Turkey, where the arrival of US Vice President Joe Biden has furnished aficionados of the diplomatic snub with quite the collector's item. The senior most official waiting to greet Air Force Two when it arrived in Ankara was the deputy mayor of Turkey's capital. Not that Biden would really have required any such reminder, but relations between the US and Turkey are currently at what the most demented optimist would assess as a low ebb. Raffaello, on the scale of diplomatic insult, where does this actually rank? Because for most countries, when the Vice President of the United States turns up, it's a pretty big deal.
Yeah, I mean, it's a clear message that's being sent by the Turks, but I think it reflects a very tense relationship between the two. But I think Turkey in general has, since the attempted coup, a month or so back now, has felt very kind of left out from the international community, very angry. And I think that they've been ranking the people who've come to see them or who've actually been showing up, and they'd noticed that the Americans had been a bit sort of hesitant. There was all these questions about Incirlik base being used as a place for some of the coup plotters to refuel some of their planes or planes from there, sorry, being used by others. And that's, of course, a base which is very heavily controlled and operated by the Americans. So there was a lot of tension here, and this is clearly a signal being sent by Turkey to the United States about their sort of displeasure and anger. Of course, Fethullah Gulen, this figure who the Turks say is behind the entire coup plot, resides in the United States, and they have made entreaties for him to be sent back for some time. That's never going to happen. So there's a lot of tension playing out, and sort of playing out in this sort of a diplomatic snub is a very clear message being sent by Turkey. In some ways, it's quite a juvenile thing, because at the end of the day, they still need the Americans quite a lot, and there's a very strong relationship that they're going to have to maintain, and they are, of course, NATO partners. But, you know, I think it's a clear message was sent.
It was the juvenile aspect of it, inevitably, that quite appealed to me. I mean, yeah. Michael, what do you think? Was it calibrated just right? Would it have been overselling it if they just sent a taxi with some guy with a piece of cardboard with right. James Bader written on it or something like that?
Well, I think if Biden had simply ignored it, as he did, it doesn't matter at all. After all, it needs two to take offence. Exactly. If you snub somebody and the eye breezily smiles and says, hello, nice to see you, does it matter? Mm-hmm. And Biden has got some tough messages. He's going to obviously try to reassure the Turks and assuage their anger up to a point. But also, I think he is going to point out the things that Raffaello said, which is that the Turks need the Americans. And do you really want to fall for Mr. Putin's embraces? Are you really going to be seduced into leaving NATO? I think not.
Well, as Raffaello points out, though, Erdogan has made an enormous song and dance about the alleged involvement of Fethullah Gulen in the coup d'etat. Fethullah Gulen, as Raffaello also points out, is a resident of Pennsylvania. Turkey has demanded his extradition. Now, I guess two questions. One, is it remotely imaginable that the United States will give him up, given the complete implausibility of him receiving a fair trial in Turkey? And two, if the US don't give him up, if that's what Erdogan is anticipating, what does he want America to throw him so he can say, I've come away with a great victory here?
Well, there's not much American can throw him in the way of extradition of this particular individual, because the Turks simply don't understand that you can't have a president wave a piece of paper and say, right, we're sending him back. You have to have due process. You have to have a trial. The country requesting his extradition has to produce evidence that is convincing to an American court that he actually has committed a crime. And I think it's going to be very hard for the Turks to show that this guy has committed a crime. I mean, they've got to produce real factual evidence. And the point is, it is a grudge match between Erdogan and this particular Islamist who used to be closely linked with Erdogan. And that is no way that America is going to be convinced that he needs to be sent back.
I mean, I guess there's also Erdogan himself needs to build bridges here as well, because he has not, if he hasn't directly insinuated that he believes that the United States was directly involved, rather, with the attempted coup d'etat, certainly officials around him have made that suggestion with little contradiction from Erdogan. We've had Biden's officials describing those allegations using Biden's favourite word, which was malarkey, which is a word I'm very fond of and I would like to see deployed more in the public discourse. But how does Erdogan now square that? He spent the last month or so insinuating that this was all an American plot. How does he now sell the idea, here I am shaking hands with the vice president?
Well, I mean, I think he sells it in the sort of easy way, which is, I am the great leader of this great country, and I'm, of course, meeting my peers from these other great countries, and it sort of elevates his importance in that way. And I'm sure the imagery that will come out will be of, them meeting in big places with large chairs and, ceremony, all the sort of ceremony and, pomp and circumstance that goes with it. So, I think that that's how he kind of sells it domestically, because, I mean, the relationship between the two is incredibly sort of awkward in many ways. The Fethullah Gulen is one component of it. The other component of it is, of course, the fight in Syria, where you've got the US who sees, frankly, the YPG, which is, a Kurdish force fighting on the ground, as one of their most effective partners. Of course, it being a Kurdish force means that the Turkish government despise them and think the Americans shouldn't be supporting them. So, this and that plays directly into sort of domestic security questions. We've had a number of attacks in linked to various Kurdish groups around the country, and not to talk of all the sort of ISIS-linked attacks that we're seeing as well. So, I mean, there's a hugely complex relationship. And in many ways, Erdogan has got to try to make sure that the Americans keep on side. But, he's got an increasingly tame domestic media who he can sort of play out his imagery through if he's got to worry about his domestic audience. And frankly, on the international stage, I don't get a very strong sense that the Turks are particularly concerned about how they're necessarily seen.
Michael, the backdrop again of this today is that Turkey is now clearly quite obviously at war in Syria. They have sent tanks across the border in support of this attempt to take Jarablus, this border town on the Euphrates, from Islamic State. This is the one where yesterday Turkey was literally shelling both sides, both Islamic State and the YPG, preparing to take it. In the last hour, as we come onto air, there's now reports suggesting that American planes are joining the attack on the side of the Turkish-sponsored Syrian militia, which was trying to take Islamic State before the American-backed Syrian Kurds did. I think that's right. I think. Do Turkey... Well, to try and resolve that with one simple question, although I realise as I ask it, there's probably not a simple answer, are Turkey and the United States in Syria basically on the same side?
Well, finally, they are, probably, but it's taken a long time. And I have to say, this Turkish incursion into Syria, the rest of the world has been wondering, well, whose side are you on? Because there have been numerous reports for the past 2 or 3 years that Turkey has willingly allowed weapons across its porous border to get to Islamic State. And it's only because Islamic State has blatantly and openly claimed responsibility for a number of big atrocities inside Turkey that finally Erdogan's government has actually intervened effectively and militarily and openly against Islamic State itself.
Well, we're going to take a short break now. You're listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Mullet, Michael Binion and Raffaello Pantucci. Coming up next, why more Europeans are buying guns.
Come on, you knew that summer couldn't last forever. It's time to think what happens in a post-lounger world. For a start, you could begin a new business, or just make the one you have better. Or you could find out how to make a fortune in TV. Here's what our editors have lined up for you this month.
In the culture section, we ask, what is the future of TV? We bet on the next big formats, territories, writers, and on-screen talent.
In the design pages, we visit the furtive furniture makers bringing Basque design into the limelight.
In the edit section, we sit down with Oscar-winning director Paolo Sorrentino for his filmic final feast, overlooking Rome.
The September issue of Monocle is on newsstands now, or get yourself a subscription. Visit monocle.com to find out how.
You're listening to Midori House on Monocle 24 with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Michael Binion and Raffaello Pantucci. Now, whatever else the perennially rancorous nations of Europe may find to disagree about, one thing, arguably the one thing, on which they can all get together is their collective sophistication relative to the United States, with particular respect to their relationship with guns. And although little unites Europeans in smug contentment more than contemplating the nation of trigger-happy yahoos across the Atlantic, that may have to change. Countries across Europe are reporting a rise in applications for firearm permits. Raffaello, this is mostly based on recent statistics from Switzerland, the Czech Republic, and Austria. Switzerland, of course, for different reasons, obviously quite heavily armed anyway, yeah, as countries go. But what do we think is bringing this on? Is it the obvious?
I mean, it feels like the obvious. And I mean, I think that if you're thinking about those three particular countries within a European context, they're ones that have, I would argue, a sort of political orientation that's probably a bit more right-leaning than some others. And so, you know, within that context, a sort of refugee story that's been the big narrative in Europe for the past, well, more than a year now, really, would play very negatively and would play into that sense of concern and security, be it from terrorists, be it from, you know, this marauding group of immigrants who may do God knows what to you. You can understand why there might be a sort of increase in gun permits. I mean, as you point out, though, Switzerland is an interesting case because, of course, everyone has a gun there at home because every man is sort of part of the army and is militarized. And actually, one of the sort of underreported stories you often see in Europe is these occasional eruptions of individual men who will suddenly exterminate their entire families in some sort of fit of rage and use the guns that they're issued by the army. And it sort of happens with the alarming regularity there, and it doesn't really get much coverage. So I'd argue actually in a Swiss case, they're probably already quite heavily armed and they already have a problem around guns. But in terms of Czech Republic and Austria, I suspect the narratives that we're seeing of sort of immigrants coming in of potential terrorist threats probably playing to a public fear.
I mean, the numbers, we should stress, aren't huge. There has just been a slight uptick. But the one that did interest me was Germany, Michael, which shows no meaningful rise in inquiries about gun permits, but a huge rise, 49% in applications for permits for carrying what are called scare devices, whether that's weapons that fire blanks or pepper spray. Why would that be a thing?
Well, two reasons. First of all, they're not a country with a gun culture. And of course, since the Second World War, there's been a very, very strong counter-military culture. But the question of security has been a big, big issue because of a number of incidents that have taken place between German women, especially, and refugees who've behaved in a way that Germans just find absolutely appalling. I mean, the famous molesting of an large number of women in Cologne on New Year's Eve and things of that kind. And there is a worry that the culture that a lot of people seem to bring with them is one where women are treated pretty disrespectfully, and German feminism is pretty militant, and therefore they're not going to put up with it.
The European gun culture, such as it is, though, and Switzerland being the exception, but elsewhere, it does seem quite entrenched, doesn't it, Raffaello? I mean, I gun laws in this country were famously tightened in 1996 after the massacre of a bunch of school kids in Dunblane. And since then, I don't perceive any great clamour for those restrictions to be undone. The same in Australia, where there was a crackdown following the Port Arthur massacre in Tasmania. And again, there's no sort of paranoia or defensiveness or demands that more access to firearms must be permitted.
I mean, I think that it probably plays as much to sort of national concerns and sort of, you know, base, I don't even know how to describe them really, sort of perceptions amongst the sort of general held perceptions amongst society of what sort of weapons are. And then sort of cultural things. I mean, if you look at some of the Nordic countries, they have a sort of tradition of guns because they have a tradition of hunting. So sort of people will use rifles and stuff for that. So that kind of fits into that context. Or if you go over to sort of Eastern Europe, where you've got sort of, you know, there's all sorts of stories of people going on sort of stag parties to, you know, the Baltics or something and, you know, going having a few drinks and then, you know, loosing off some rounds in an AK-47 at some shooting range. But you don't hear about sort of mass shootings happening there. So it does seem to play to different cultures in each and every country. And I'm not sure one can cleanly explain each and every one of them.
It's this idea that, I mean, I can understand the ownership of a weapons if you're a farmer or a hunter, or even if you use one for recreational purposes, people do. But it's this idea of that owning a firearm would make you somehow safer. Would you personally, Michael, feel safer if you owned a gun or carried one about your person? Maybe you are, I don't know.
Well, not in the least, because I wouldn't know how to
What
fire it.
Should I?
I'd probably do myself a terrible damage trying to fire the thing. There's no culture of arms carrying in Britain. I mean, almost none at all.
Even among the police.
Well, no, not among the police. I mean, yes, there are illegal guns and there is worry about them, but it's a tiny minority of people. And there certainly isn't the culture anywhere in Europe of citizen protection of themselves with firearms as a right, a constitutional right, which is what is the case in America. And there has never been that. And I don't think even with this concern about potential threats from, you know, outsiders, we're not going to see that kind of culture developing.
OK, we should move finally along tonight to a media story, which is that the New York Times is looking increasingly serious in its ambitions to become much more than a city newspaper. Having already launched a Spanish language edition out of Mexico City earlier this year, the Times has now announced plans to set up in Canada and Australia. Michael, this comes a few years after it made quite high-profile attempts and quite high-profile failures in India, Brazil and China, which all failed to take for various reasons. Why do they think Canada and Australia are a better bet?
Same language. Much easier. Or almost the same language. I mean, officially the same language. I think this is a pretty desperate move, actually. I don't think it will work because newspapers very, very rarely easily transcend borders. Newspapers cater for specific audiences with specific reference points, even if it's the same language. The only ones that actually get across borders are those that deal with international subjects such as finance. So you have the Wall Street Journal, the Financial Times, which have quite healthy sales elsewhere. The New York Times, which is essentially oriented towards America and for Americans, it doesn't translate in Australia.
I mean, they will doubtless hire Australian journalists, but even so, they would be exporting their culture in the same way that The Guardian has to Australia, where it is read online, but it also lost $10 million last
year. Well, indeed. Mm. I mean, you can have a website. That's slightly different. It's not the same as a newspaper. A website is really not culturally specific, and it's just a kind of news website, and it's a chance for people to have their own say in their own comments and whatever. And that perhaps is more successful. Now, for New York Times wants to continue the wonderfully old-fashioned idea of having a newspaper printed on paper, which I love, but it doesn't translate overseas, I don't think.
What do you think, Raffaella? Do you think that because there is a cultural difference, certainly, between American newspapers and British newspapers, and there, I know for a fact that there's one between Australian and British and American newspapers. It's possibly because I am Australian that I have, at the risk of committing a great heresy, always found the New York Times almost unreadably tedious. Do you think it can, if it is going to translate, does it need to stay true to its core values, or should it try to adapt?
Well, I mean, I think it has to adapt to some degree, because otherwise, as you know, Michael said, newspapers are inherently very local concepts and local products, and so they have to talk to their particular audience. I mean, I think it's interesting because the New York Times has, you know, they set up, I didn't actually realize they did it in New York Times Espanol, which is out of Mexico City, but I have noticed that they do one in Chinese, and they do a lot of stuff in China, and actually some of the China stuff they do is very interesting and very well done, and there is some very specific stories that they do kind of get out, which are very kind of Chinese specific. The problem is, of course, it's actually blocked in China, so it's not reaching that particular audience, but the work is actually very good and is very sort of specific. Now, if they're able to replicate that in a kind of Australian or Canadian context, fantastic, maybe, but I wonder a little bit about the success of sort of doing it, just because it is the same language that they're doing it in. And so the question will be, why would people go look at that? I think if you're in China and you speak and read Chinese only, then you might look for the New York Times because it's being broadcast in your particular language and others can't access it. But the New York Times is already accessible to everyone in Canada and Australia because it is from the same language, notwithstanding whatever slight quirks and differences there may be. So, you know, I do wonder, they're going to have to do something quite interesting and special and different to really be able to penetrate that market, I suspect.
We shall be keeping an eye on that. But for now, that is all we have time for on today's Midori House. Michael Binion and Raffaello Pantucci, thank you very much for joining us. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Rabello, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Ximena Mignan. Our studio manager was Weidong Lin. There's more music next. Carlotta will be your host for that. 1900 Hours, The Entrepreneurs with Daniel Giacopelli, and we'll have more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. I'll be your host for that as well. Midori House returns at the same time tomorrow. That's 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Miller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye. We'll